Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's Friday, March 29th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Donald Trump is rich. We've established this. Sadly, for anyone with a sense of karma, or for most people who've ever contracted with him, certainly for the Polish laborers on Trump Tower. Now, no person is illegal, right? We know that these people were just paid by Trump illegally to illegally work on his tower because their immigration status was not, strictly speaking, what's the word? Oh, yeah, legal. I hope we haven't offended him or any sons of Saint Stanislaus. But you know who in Trump's orbit got much less rich because of their very association with the man? Well, quite a few people. Peter Navarro, Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, Alan Weisselberg, George Papadopoulos. They all went to jail. Okay, Papadopoulos for 12 days. And we do have to say Weisselberg. He probably is a net positive for all his dealings with Trump. Though, jailing, that's a lateral move. Then there's Mike Lindell. You know him from such conspiracy theories as all of them about the election, and such infomercials as
the best pillow in history, MyPillow 2.0. Just like all of you, I never imagined that MyPillow could get any better. That's why I haven't changed it in nearly 20 years. Then I heard about a revolutionary new technology, and I knew I had to bring it to y'all. MyPillow 2.0 is truly the next generation of MyPillow.
The MyPillow 2.0 is cooler and softer than the last MyPillow. It is so comfortable to sleep on at night. I look forward to going to bed, and I wake up well rested in the morning.
Sleep is all about temperature and height. MyPillow 2.0's patented adjustable fill is going to give you the exact individual support you need from your head to your bed.
Lindell was not the subject of a class action suit from angry MyPillow 1.0 users who felt they were lied to and misled over the patent technology that provided an unbeatable firm comfort sleep. Then Lindell comes around and beats it. Ugh, it's just laying the case and exposing himself legally. Speaking of which, well, we'll get to that. Lindell was sued when he transitioned from betting huckster to election denier. WCCO Minneapolis has the latest consequence.
New today, the MyPillow company has been kicked out of a building where they make pillows. The landlord of this building in Shakopee says MyPillow owes more than $200,000 in rent and other charges. Because of that, a judge evicted the company.
In 2020, as part of a roadshow, literally, he went on tour, touting claims that China manipulated voting machines to steal the 2020 election, he launched his Prove Mike Wrong Challenge. $5 million to anyone who could prove that, quote, packet captures were not valid data from the 2020 election. So Robert Zeidman, a guy who wrote a book about detecting evidence of wrongdoing in computer code, well situated to accept the challenge, did so. He proved Lindell wrong, and Lindell said, "You got me." No, of course he didn't. He refused to pay. It went to court. An arbitration panel ruled he needed to pay. Lindell said, "Well, I'm not personally liable. It's only a business liability, the business of election fraud assertions being so intertwined with the business of placing stuffing and goose feathers inside stitched together pieces of fabric." But now we're seeing some real-world consequences, as you heard, some economic impact from Mr. Lindell's baseless claim. On the other hand, Lindell's mentor in matters of infotainment and election fanfic, Donald Trump, he's not been materially affected by any of his lies. One does guess, however, that the former president, like many of Mr. Lindell's customers, sleeps comfortably at night, though In Trump's case, more due to sociopathy rather than award-winning pillow technology, which you just know Trump would never let touch his highly curated head. On the show today, great news, it is a full show interview, but let me give this observation, this contemplation as we get into the interview. So earlier this week, I think that's right, we had Whitney Downard of the Indiana Capital Chronicle, and she was discussing a social service funding issue in her state. There was a misforecast, and it turns out something like 40,000 Hoosiers will have to go without services, including families of severely autistic children, the elderly. Home health care funds were set aside to pay for them. Now they're not. So there are $1 billion in the hole to help 40,000 people, some of the most vulnerable people. What do you do? Well, it reminds me of an interview I just conducted, which will air soon, with Keith Humphreys, and he's an addiction specialist at Stanford. We were talking about Measure 110 in Oregon, which I've talked about before. It was repealed, the attempted destigmatization and decriminalization of hard drugs. But one of the critiques, and I think most experts think this was a fair one, is that the funding for treatment was only $250 million. More than 1,000 people will wind up or have wound up overdosing last year alone. So now we're bringing you another story about the costs of treatment that could help people. What we're talking about now is Ozempic or Wegovy, that class of drugs. And what will it cost? I'll give some of the shock of the interview away. If we funded it, it would cost $1 trillion. Net cost of about $800 billion because it costs about $200 billion just to deal with the consequences of obesity. 40% of the population would benefit. Should we do it? To me, this is politics, and this is what the discussion and our discussion of politics should be. What choices do we want to make? We have limited resources. Yes, richest country in the world and all that, and we have been since we were less rich, much less rich than we are now. And yes, we print the reserve currency of the world. It doesn't matter. We are constrained by the amount we could spend, and we need to decide what we want to spend it on. And to me, what I do is engage in discussion, often about politics, but so many of our political discussions aren't about this. It's about who's right, who's wrong, who's good, who's bad, who's lying. It's actually more about their lying. We think that our political enemies, opponents, people we disagree with are beholden to incorrect facts, wrong thinking, misinformation. We don't credit them for having different opinions. Even if we do, the discussion is almost never of different priorities, limited resources, who best to spend it on. Now, there's a reason why the discussions aren't always forthright. Sometimes you gain or one party gains power, and they don't really have to engage in a discussion that credits the minority party. But in general, in America, where a 50-50-ish country, we're at each other's throats, I would like most of the political discussion to be how to prioritize our limited resources. So with that in mind, I had this discussion. We're talking about Ozempic, Wegovy, miracle drugs. They do a lot. The results of these drugs would be of enormous benefit for a near majority of the populace. So what can the government do to subsidize the job of government to foster human flourishing, in this case, to specifically abate the suffering of obesity? Shouldn't we do something? Up next, a man who's looked at the issue from an economic and ethical perspective. Here is Jonathan Gruber, architect of the Affordable Care Act, you should know, chair of the MIT Economics Department. And today, we will be discussing paying for Ozempic.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
GLP-1 receptor agonists. Do I have your attention? Well, what if I told you Ozempic and Wegovy? These are kind of, the phrase gets tossed around, but a little bit of miracle drugs. They really work. And obesity is, I don't think it's too much of a bit of hyperbole to say, an epidemic. These are drugs that can absolutely transform the lives of the almost 40% of adults who are experiencing, I'm sure their advocates wouldn't say that I should use the verb suffering, from obesity. But obesity does cause suffering, and these are the drugs that can cure it or address it. The problem, a price tag, a huge price tag. In fact, if Americans were to pay just out of pocket, well, we'll get to the estimates in a second, because I want to talk about these drugs as public policy. Joining me now is Jonathan Gruber, who's the chairman of the economics department at MIT. He has co-authored an op-ed in the New York Times talking about this exactly. Welcome, Professor Gruber.
Good to be here, Mike.
Give me a sense of how transformative, either health-wise or monetary-wise, these drugs are.
Well, look, Mike, we have to start with the fact that this is a major public health problem. In fact, the major public health problem, now that we finally addressed smoking in this country over the last few decades, the major health issue facing our country is obesity. 40% of the U.S. is obese. It's expected to rise to 50% by 2030. One in three children born today will have diabetes by the time they die. It's a huge problem. It's the major public health problem facing our country. And now we may have the answer, which is these drugs, the GLP-1 antagonists, essentially seem miraculous. Basically, I heard it best described as we all have a range between liking something and wanting something. Sometimes we want things we don't even necessarily like. We just kind of want them because they're in front of us. It's called craving. We all know it. You know, the bowl of chips in front of you, have the chips. This seems to sort of, these drugs seem to lower craving without actually lowering enjoyment of life or many other side effects. It's just they somehow figure to find the sweet spot between like and want, where they've sort of lowered craving, and as a result seem to have enormously beneficial effects on weight loss, perhaps even on other kinds of craving.
And it's right. And as far as just putting out disclaimers, it is true that when you take the drugs, you have to do something to replace the mass, the muscle mass that you may lose, that the drugs are like brushing your teeth. You have to take them all the time. If you go off them, the cravings return and probably almost definitely the weight will be put back on. But then on the other side, we're not exactly sure how they work. And it does seem to reduce cravings like gambling addiction. They might even have more benefits. It's all a very interesting and I would say promising but expensive stew.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. We don't know how far this can go. It's incredibly exciting. I think we need to start there. It's also incredibly expensive. It's $15,000 a year is the list price. Some people get discounts, but it's $15,000 a year is the list price. And it's every year forever. As far as we can tell, you have to stay in these drugs forever. Fascinating article that people are actually want to do that. There's people, amazing article the other day said that people who are non-adherent, that means they don't take drugs for life-threatening diseases, will stay religiously on their Wegovy because they're seeing the weight loss. So it's expensive. And that's sort of the point of our editorial, is that it's expensive not just for the people, but potentially enormously expensive for the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's the price. What's the cost, though? How much do obesity-related illnesses cost us as a country?
Well, okay, so basically obesity-related illnesses, we think, cost us about more than $200 billion annually. So a very big number. And it makes sense. You think of all the diabetes and the enormous toll that takes on our medical system. Obesity-related illness is very expensive. And that's the motivation for saying, hey, here's an answer. Let's get obese people to have advantage of this miraculous drug. And that's why it's appealing.
Mm-hmm. And how much will it cost all of America if they were paying list price, who needs the drug, to get the drug?
Well, this is the great question. Define needs the drug. So right now, it's restricted very narrowly, probably too narrowly. there are many people who benefit from the drug who aren't necessarily being covered. On the other hand, if every obese person took the drug, was eligible for the drug in America, not everyone would take it. But we estimate that if every obese person was eligible for the drug, it would cost the U.S. government $800 billion every single year. To fix ideas, a lot of big numbers get thrown around. Mike, that is something like the entire cost of the Medicare program for those over 65. It's a big number.
Yeah, I just, well, in the article, it says $1 trillion.
Well, it's $1 trillion, and then you have savings. So it's $1 trillion of the cost minus about $200 billion of savings. So you end up with about $800 billion on net in terms of U.S. government costs. Now, look, let's be clear. This is an estimate that involves a lot of uncertainty. You know, I'm not staking my life on this particular number. What I am saying is that the number is really big. Even if it ends up being half as big, that $400 billion a year is enormous.
Yes.
And this means we need to, before the number gets that big, as we say, before the fiscal horse gets out of the barn, we need to start thinking about how we're going to address this.
And we'll get to that in a second, but I want to put it in other terms for context. You said the entire Medicaid system, the entire Pentagon budget is less than $800 billion. So it does seem, in a way, I know that the purpose of government is to provide for the common defense and for the general flourishing, but it would seem odd to me to have a federal budget where more money goes for obesity drugs than the Pentagon.
Look, once again, it's not necessarily the wrong thing to do. So if these drugs are as miraculous as they are, and if we are paying a price that is consistent with their social value, and let's come back to what social value means, then whatever it costs. You know,
yeah.
If we decide that the social value of these drugs is high and we as a society want to spend money on it, then that's a legitimate decision. Look, Mike, we can come back to this. We have actually a very small government in the context of international development. So if you took, let's just put it this way. If these new drugs cost $800 billion more and we raised U.S. taxes to pay for all that, we would go from being the 14th highest tax burden in the world to the 12th highest tax burden in the world. Mm-hmm. It's not like we would suddenly shut down as a society. So
right.
We can afford it, but just because we can afford it doesn't mean we should, and we need to pay attention to whether it's worth spending money on.
So I would also think politically, if your statistics are correct, and I think they are, that more than 40% of people have obesity, and then factor in how many people might not, they themselves have it, but they have a family member who's struggled with it and would like to help them. I think it would be very politically popular to have a bill. I mean, to have a bill that essentially subsidizes the use of these drugs. I can imagine the arguments, you know, the social responsibility arguments and the back and forth. But just in practical terms, we as a government are going to subsidize and fund your health and the lessening of your obesity. I could scarcely think of a more popular political notion that's ever been proposed in my lifetime.
Well, I mean, it's popular, but once again, the trick is who's eligible. So right now, many people on it are not even obese. So my friends in Palo Alto told me everyone in Palo Alto is on this drug, regardless of whether they're obese. And this is a really interesting issue face, which is who is eligible for it. Right now, it's restricted. It's restricted. Many people who would benefit from it are restricted from getting it. The question is, for example, do you only put it people who are suffering from heart disease or people who are at risk? And how do you define at risk? And our estimate could be conservative. You know, in addition to the 40% of Americans who are obese, there's another 30% who are overweight. And what if they start taking it? So I think the point of our article is not the scary headline numbers to get your attention to the fact that we cannot just leave this to the private market to work out.
Mm-hmm.
We as a society need to step forward and address what are we willing to spend and who are we willing to spend it on.
Yeah. Logically, so right now the rules are those eligible have to have type 2 diabetes. There is a category, a medically recognized category called pre-diabetes. And then there's also the logical category that if you have obesity for a number of years, it might not show up in your, what is it, the A1C, but you're probably,
H-A-1-C, yeah.
Yes, you're probably on the way towards pre-diabetes. So add it all up. It seems generally useful, but we haven't gotten to what you're talking about, which is, okay, what do we do about the $1 trillion price tag or the $800 billion net price tag? What do we do about that? How do we get it down?
Well, I think that there's a couple of ideas that aren't a good idea. So one would be by restricting it excessively. We want it. So for example, right now it's available for diabetics. Well, in fact, that's actually not necessarily the best population. It's really the pre-diabetics.
Yeah.
We want people, once you're diabetic, you're diabetic forever. We want to stop people from becoming diabetic. The first bad thing to do would be to restrict it excessively. The second would be to say, okay, we'll allow it, but people have to pay for it, because most of those who struggle with weight problems are low income and they couldn't afford it. So that's another idea we do not think is a good idea. There should be some patient skin in the game, and I believe that should be based on your income. I think the richer you are, the more you should have to pay for it. But that's not going to help people who are low income who can't afford $15,000. And that's why we come to the third approach, which is to do what the rest of the world does, Mike, the rest of the developed world, and actually regulate the prices that we charge for our prescription drugs.
And we do it too, or we started doing it, right? But right now, Ozempic and Wegovy wouldn't qualify for the few drugs that benefit from U.S. negotiation, I think, as
yeah,
I understand.
Yeah, Mike, so basically, this has been a longstanding battle. And the first salvo on the government's favor was fired through the Inflation Reduction Act, which actually created a small list of drugs at the discretion of the Secretary of the Health and Human Services can regulate. That's currently 10 drugs. That list expands slowly. Wegovy and Ozempic, two of the drugs, I think one other, would be eligible as early as 2027. But others, which are being invented now, would not be eligible into the 2030s for regulation on this list.
And so, I also want to establish the regulation could work because there is an enormous profit margin on these drugs. And we know that because of how much Novo Nordisk that makes it, how much they charge the Danes in their home country for the drugs. And it's about it's about what, 20% of what they charge Americans?
Yeah, it's $3,500 instead of $15,000.
Yeah.
Once again,
and they're not selling it at a loss in Denmark.
They're not selling at a loss. Now, this is what it raises an interesting issue, Mike, and we should come back to this, which is what they will argue is, while each unit of this drug is not that expensive to produce, the costs of developing the drug are very expensive. And they will say, if what the drug companies will argue is, the reason they can afford to sell cheaply in Europe is because they sell at such high prices in the U.S. They admit this, that the high price in the U.S. help pay for the research and development that produce the next generation of great drugs. And the research and development they're doing is very valuable. But what I've argued in my work, and I have a book called Jumpstarting America with Simon Johnson, where we go into this argument in much more detail. What we've heard in our work is what that misses. Essentially, what the drug companies are saying is, it's sort of like the old gangster, like, you know, nice story you had there, be ashamed if something happened to it, pay me protection. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit the drug companies are saying, well, nice drugs you have there. Be ashamed if we didn't do R&D anymore. You got to pay us high prices.
Yeah.
But what they're missing is, if those high prices starve the government also does some of the incredibly valuable R&D that makes this all possible. The reason these drugs exist is because the National Institutes of Health does the basic scientific research on which they're all based. If the U.S. government gets starved by $800 billion, and has to cut NIH, we're going to be worse off, not better off. And that is what these arguments miss, that if the savings from regulating drugs accrue to the taxpayer, we can reinvest some of those in actually creating a new generation of even more valuable drugs.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know how compelling it would be to a profit-seeking drug company, or how compelling it would have to be. What my mind comes to is, yeah, it's true that they need a certain amount of profits to pursue their research, a certain amount, but how much? I mean, these are publicly traded companies. We know what their profit margins are. When they hit, we know that their profits go through the roof. And in fact, I think in any negotiation, if the United States, with all of its purchasing power, goes to Novo Nordisk or any other company and say, all right, for the first couple of years, we didn't have our stuff together and we couldn't negotiate prices, but now you're going to have to take a haircut, right? You're not going to make your profit margins of 5 times what you charge the Danes, but double what you charge the Danes. I think they might take it, because what other choice would they have? We're something of a monopsony, aren't we?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think that profit margins, you know, there's really two ways to think about regulating something. One way is the way we regulate water or electricity. which is to say, look, we know what it costs to produce it. We're going to add on top a reasonable profit margin and we'll let you charge that price. That's called cost plus regulation. That's actually kind of hard to do for drug development because the costs are hard to measure.
Right, so, because it's not a commodity like water.
Yeah, exactly. So the other way to regulate it, which is what the rest of the world does for drugs, is to do what's called value-based regulation, which is say, we will study the social value added of your drug in terms of how much it improves health, and we'll regulate it according to that price. And we should do that here too. Now, that's not going to say that, for example, that might say it ends up with a price higher than what the Danes pay. We might say, look, the Danes are paying less than the social value. And I think we should, as a society, that should be our starting point for negotiation, is what is the social value of the drug? And we go from there.
Now, to calculate social value, the easy part is your number of how much we pay in prices for obesity-related illnesses, like $250 billion. And that's why you, I think, correctly took it off the $1 trillion price tag to talk about net. But when it's beyond, all right, this is how many people go to the hospital, this is how many people have to go on kidney dialysis, when it's just something like quality of life, that becomes very hard to calculate, does it not? How do you, as an economist, calculate that?
You know, it's what we say in economics, an opportunity and a challenge. It's sort of where economics almost meets ethics, which is how do you think about quality of life? So we have something in economics we call quality adjusted life years, which is basically if you have a medical intervention and it lengthens your life and we measure what that's worth, we have an estimated value of a year of life, which comes from economic studies. We can get into where that comes from. But that's the estimated value of life in full health. We say, well, what is the benefit of extending your life in partial health, et cetera? And there's a wonderful institution called the Institute for Comparative Effectiveness Research, or ICER. They do that in America. Now, in England, it's done by the wonderfully named, I love the folks in England, they're called NICE, the National Institute for Comparative Effectiveness. They're the ones that tell you you can't have something, but they're called NICE.
Right. We're at least honest about it. We're ICER.
We're at least honest about it. We give it a boring name.
We're cold. Yeah.
So basically that's a regulatory body in England. In the US, it's a purely voluntary organization and they do studies and they try to put the science behind, okay, how do we value what it's worth to, for someone to not have diabetes? How do we value what it's worth to someone to not have this weight gain? And there's a lot of uncertainty around that, but they do the best job available. Their estimate for these drugs, for those who are need them the most, so this is not for the average obese person, for those need them the most, is around $7,000. So it's higher than what the Dane pay, but that's not for everybody who's obese. And they haven't produced an estimate for, I think, the people who would actually take it. People who need it the most, you know, if they cut their price by 50% or 60%, they might be in the right range. But the problem is it's going to be hard for doctors to restrict it to those individuals. And that's going to be the challenge. Society is for those who are just merely obese and not at various health risks, the price probably should be lower.
And we will be back with more from Jonathan Gruber after the break.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
We're back with Jonathan Gruber, Ford Professor of Economics at MIT. He's chair of the economics department there. We continue our discussion. look at the size of the weight loss market, right? All the supplements, all the diet plans, all the gummies and jellies and capsules and powders. And it's hundreds of billions of dollars. So yeah. I would say that that's a real tangible number. I don't know that it would go away. And there'd probably be some costs to the, there certainly would be some cost to the economy if there wasn't a weight loss industry. But it would overall, I think it should overall factor into this ICE slash NICE calculation.
Yeah, I think, look, there's lots of ways to do this. And I think ultimately the answer, what I'm here to say today, Mike, is not so much I know how to do it, but that we have to do it.
Yeah,
that we can't. Look, I teach basic economics. What I teach my kids is when markets work well, the government should just let them work. The market for apples, we got to make sure the apples are safe, but like we shouldn't regulate the price of apples. There's lots of competition. People can shop for them. They know what they're getting. There's no market that works less well than healthcare. Everything that goes wrong with the market goes wrong in healthcare. And that's why every other country in the world, every other developed country in the world does not let the free market set prices for healthcare. We're the only one that does. And guess what? Our healthcare costs are 33 to 50% more than other developed countries, even controlling for our income level and things like that, because we've made the mistake of not recognizing the government needs to regulate these prices.
If the Wegovys and Ozempics were more like insulin or AIDS medication, life-saving, would it be an easier calculation or political task?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's not a lot of controversy over things which extend your life. So if you say, look, I have a drug, which when you're, if you're going to die, if you're perfectly healthy and going to die randomly, and I can make it so that you live five more years, we kind of know what that's worth. What's harder is when it, for example, just improves your health, but doesn't extend your life, or when it extends your life, but you're in less than perfect health. That's where the calculations get a lot harder.
Mm. I'm going to throw something at you that I don't know if you're equipped to deal with, but I don't know how familiar you are with the fat acceptance movement, or it goes by many names, but this does a number of beneficial things, like push back against some of our societal imagery and messaging around weight loss. But at the more extreme ends, and I've had some people on the show talk about this, they do things like deny that obesity has a health risk and just so want to destigmatize the idea of obesity that they're in a lot of denial, I would say. But there's an interesting thing going on here, and this is where it's probably beyond your ken, but I'll throw it at you, that I think that there is a possibility for the majority of that message, if it really gets out and is embraced, to move along this conversation in a really beneficial way, which is to convince people who might otherwise say, I don't want my tax dollars going for some drug just because people can't stop eating, or they eat poorly. You know, if you can educate people or change the thinking about that, it would go very far. The problem is, I don't know if the fat acceptance movement or the more prominent and sometimes radical adherents thereof are in a position to do that, because they also say, you know, how dare you tell us not to be overweight? And the whole idea of Wegovy and Ozempic is a lot of people don't want to be overweight. But I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, Mike, I have a lot of thoughts on that. I thought about that a lot. And I want to raise a couple of issues around that. The first issue is that we need to accept all body types, and we need to recognize that we should be accepting of that. But we also need to recognize that for many people, they would rather weigh less. And I think the problem is, so for example, I talked about these calculations that value life. So for example, those calculations would probably say that people's lives, that people, if you ask people, would you rather weigh less? They'll say yes. And they would say, as a result, we are going to value people's lives as worth more, or value their happiness as higher when they weigh less. And these groups would say that's wrong. That's discriminatory, because you're saying people who are heavy are worth less. We're not saying it's a mathematical implication of those calculations, but it's because most people express that they would rather weigh less. And so we're just incorporating that. So that's one thing, which is, I think it can get in the way of doing those calculations. If you say, no, we're not allowed, you know, at the most extreme, you know, disability advocates will often say, well, these calculations, for example, value less, your life less. We'll say a drug that extends your life but keeps you in a wheelchair is worth less than a drug that extends your life but keeps you mobile.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd all agree that.
Yeah.
But disability groups say, well, that says people in a wheelchair are worth less. It's not saying that, but does, to be fair, it has that mathematical implication. And that is the challenge. So that's issue one. On the other hand, where I'm very sympathetic to these groups is issue two, which is you might say, well, look, what's the harm? I mean, so far these drugs have minimal side effects. They're great to keep weight down. The harm is in changing our social norms. I mean, imagine being a teenager, especially a teenage girl, in a world of these drugs. I mean, you could never be anything but not skinny. Right. Because they'd be like, well, why aren't you just dealing with that? I mean, so I think it will. I think where these groups have a great point is it will just massively increase the social pressure unjustifiably to be low weight. And then finally, I think the third point is this really large issue. You know, Mike, I worked on the Affordable Care Act, and part of what we did in the Affordable Care Act was make it so sick people didn't have to pay more for health insurance than healthy people, which I thought was a big win.
Seems fundamental to the
fundamental fairness. Every other country does it.
The entire thinking behind the plan. Yeah.
Tens of thousands of critical emails, and the ones that were, you know, legible, not swear filled, often said to me, "Well, why should I pay more for health insurance because my neighbor can't control themselves?"
Right.
And you know, it's a really hard issue because to some extent, obesity is genetic, and it's not a matter of self-control. To some extent, it is a matter of self-control, and I think we need to recognize that we shouldn't have black and white thinking about this. We need to recognize that both things can be true. And people need to be sympathetic for those who struggle with weight because that can be a difficult issue. But we also need to recognize as a society that if there are things we can do to help people struggling with weight, we should do so, even if it might imply a lack of fat, implicit body shaming.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about politics, which is, you had a lot of experience as one of the main architects of the ACA, and you also worked on the Massachusetts plan that sometimes gets called Romney Care. So you have a lot of experience, not just on what the right thing to do is in terms of medical outcomes and in terms of economic outcomes, but in terms of messaging. Are there any messaging lessons that you learned that maybe showed up in the framing of the op-ed or other things that you think need to be done in order to sell this to the public or to the stakeholders?
That's a great question, Mike. I think that the messaging, the lesson I believe in most strongly is that numbers matter. That putting an estimate out there that's credible, and our estimate's been criticized, and some valid criticism. There's some uncertainty in our estimate, but it's the right order of magnitude. To put an estimate out there which is credible and draws attention to the issue is very valuable. So I think that's important, and I think to explain to people the real pocketbook issues that if the government is spending $400, $500, $800 billion more, someone's going to lose. Okay. Either taxes are going to go up, which I think we can afford, but people don't like that, or programs are going to get cut. And remember, no one wants to cut. Remember the budgetary politics. No one wants to cut Social Security. No one wants to cut Medicare. So all of a sudden you're down. No one wants to cut defense. So you're down to a tiny share of the government budget can actually be cut, what we call non-defense discretionary spending. Unless you wipe out essentially that entire part of the budget, you can't afford this. So basically the messaging lesson, Mike, is we need to have people recognize the budget constraint. They understand this may be a great drug and may want to do it, but someone's going to have to pay for it.
So you co-wrote this op-ed with Brian Deese and Ryan Cummings, and they're Biden. They were both worked in the Biden administration in economic capacities. What about Republican buy-in? I'm not sure. I don't know. I can't precisely predict that this will become a partisan issue, though most things in America do. I would understand what the traditional conservative objection to A, government spending, and B, an issue of self-control might be. But have you thought about ways to make this a more bipartisan issue to specifically appeal to Republicans? Because I thought of a couple things, but what have you thought of?
Well, I think the main way to make this appealing to Republicans, the Republicans that are willing to take the issue seriously, which aren't necessarily all of them, but to the ones that are willing to take the fiscal issue seriously and recognize that, you know, this is a money issue, and that ultimately they don't want to raise taxes. They want to cut taxes. And there's just not enough room otherwise to cut the government budget to make this work. I think the other thing to emphasize is the compelling argument they always come back with is, well, gee, we can't cut the price of drugs because it'll cut into R&D. And once again, I come back to that starving the government is not the answer. I'm a big fan of pharmaceutical R&D. It's been miraculous. But the government R&D costs go hand in hand with pharmaceutical R&D. And if you say we're going to starve the government to give excessive profits to drug companies, that is just not a winning proposition.
Yeah, that's a good argument for the Republicans who are rationally thinking about the budget. I was thinking of more the emotional level and what would maybe cause some Republicans to see a political benefit in it, some of their constituencies that might want this. And it's to emphasize, in the beginning I talked about form a more perfect union and ensure domestic tranquility and provide for the common defense. But of course, there is promoting welfare and securing the blessings of liberty. And it is, if one is obese, they spend less time with their family. If one is obese, they might run out of breath walking up a hill with their kids. It just impinges the quality of life and the quality of family life. And I think there is a very human way to communicate this. And if you get a couple of prominent stakeholders on the Republican or conservative side buying in, I don't know. I think it could go a long way.
I think it could, Mike. I think you raise the challenge, which is not so much that the Republican side wants to align themselves with the obesity rights or non-body shaming population, but they're going to use this as yet another elite attack on real Americans. So I think the view is they would say, well, you know, these people want to take away your rights to eat what you want and look any way you want. And they don't really mean it in the way they say it. It's just a convenient, reason to attack what would be a sensible government policy.
Yeah. That's interesting. It'll be interesting, though, if they make that claim and then so many of their constituents are like, I'd love to lose 30 pounds and have the government pay for it. That's why, yeah, I'd vote for anyone who helps me do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I know it's fascinating. I think it tars this larger issue we're struggling with society post-COVID, Mike, which is the so-called sort of health freedom movement. I mean, stuff like my parents' county in Florida, they propose removing fluoride from the water under dental health freedom. I mean, it's just, in some sense, it comes back to this even larger issue, which is just to what extent as a society do we respect expertise? And to what extent do we say, look, there's actually medical expertise. And, I know you're a Jets fan, but Aaron Rodgers is wrong. You shouldn't do your own research. You should actually, respect medical experts.
Yeah.
And and that this is sort of tied to that larger set of issues.
Yeah. Well, he got his ligaments repaired by experts. I noticed that. Right. He didn't have
Absolutely.
Joe Rogan operating
Absolutely.
On the ankle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Jonathan Gruber is the chairman of the economics department at MIT and one of the co-authors of the miracle weight loss drug is also a major budgetary threat. You know, the headline had a ticking time bomb, but I think it's more promising than threatening. At least that was my takeaway from the article. Thank you so much.
Excellent. You bet, Mike.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, Gperu, Duperu, and thanks for listening.